This is Dr. Gloria Sarto, and this is tape two, side one. And you were talking about Lamaze.
Lamaze, you know, the patient that I had that had gone through Lamaze. Well, there weren't a lot of folks using it, but at the time that this patient had Lamaze, they finally were allowing husbands in delivery rooms.
Did the two come together?
No, or not.
Husbands came first.
No, after.
After.
Yeah.
Okay.
It took quite a while before they'd allow that. And then they kept thinking it was going to interfere with their education because I can't have you deliver the baby if the fathers are at the head of the table and all of that. But, you know, it all worked out. But that was a big, big problem. At least that was sort of the impetus to keep the husbands out.
So that the residents could deliver the babies?
Yeah, that's what the issue was.
Sure.
We continued to deliver babies and any big problem. Anyway, so we had, I had this woman who had gone through Lamaze with a friend and her husband, who was a truck driver. Her husband was a truck driver. And she had the friend go through as well because if her husband was going to be gone, she wanted someone there to coach her. And so, as a matter of fact, when she went into labor, her husband was gone. And she, her friend coached her, and when I moved the patient into the delivery room, I said to their friend, why don't you come in? You've been coaching her. You can help her at the head of the table. And so she came in, and the delivery went really very nicely. And she did coach her because, you know, that helped a lot, having someone at the head of the table. And so it went very well, except the next day I got a letter from the chief of staff, a meritor, a Madison General, and they said they revoked my privileges because I had allowed this friend in the delivery room. And so, again, you know, I said, yeah, I can't. They can't revoke my privileges, but then obviously I told Ben, and he went and said, listen, that's baloney. You can't take her privileges away. So anyway, I'll try to find that letter if I can.
And this is a letter?
Oh, from the chief of staff at Madison General telling me they revoked my privileges and I couldn't deliver any babies there. And so anyway, we got over that hump. And and so that...
Now, would he have let... The chief of staff would have left the husband in the room at that
time.
Oh,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
But not the female friend.
Not the female friend. That was not allowed. So that was OB. And all this time that I was working on my PhD, I started then getting into... sex chromosome abnormalities. So it was X and Y chromosome abnormalities. And because of that, then we would see kids with intersex genitalia. And so I started doing the surgery on those kids, along with Dave Euling, who was the chief of urology. And we had a team, as a matter of fact, that was the intersex team. And interesting, because I work out at Harbor, and Dick Anderson works out there, too. And so it was myself, David Euling, John Opitz, and a pediatric endocrinologist. I don't know if it was Gordon Tuffley or not. I'd have to ask him. And Dick Anderson, who was a pediatric psychiatrist. So that we would meet with the parents and the children, and decide a plan of management. And this is sort of betwixt and between because, and we had other anomalies of the genitalia on girls, and so, you know, if they had adrenal genital syndrome, they'd have an enlarged phallus, and we would do surgery after when they're about 5 or 6 years old to make it smaller and all of that. So we did a lot of that surgery, and I did a lot of it. But it was also a time when kids were raised, born with some anomalies, whether they should be raised as males or females. And John Money had written his book, who you probably all have heard about, and now he's really being condemned. On the other hand, he was the only one that was writing anything at that time. And I went to one of his meetings, as a matter of fact, and I do have his book, his first book, I think. And so we were sort of betwixt and between with some of these children. And as a matter of fact, on occasion, they were males, but if they had intersex genitalia, they were raised as females. And so this I even did when I went to Northwestern in Chicago, as a matter of fact. I went to the Children's Hospital in Chicago. They have a urologist there, and so I was helping them do their surgery as well. I was doing that sort of surgery, and it was great having this team, because we really did, I think, a great, great thing for the children. And, there was a tragic case. I don't know if I tell you about this, but a woman who had a male child, and she didn't want a male, so she cut off the phallus right at, almost at the skin. And so we had to deal with that, and we worked really hard. We went to consultation in California to say, well, what should this child do? And what we ended up having him raised as a male and trying to get this to grow with testosterone and stuff when he got older, but it was a tragic, tragic thing. But anyway, those are the sorts of cases that I did. And going along that theme, we were, my work with Avon Klaus really was on X chromosome abnormalities, and we really had some major discoveries with that. I mean, we're the ones that define the point on the X chromosome around which it condenses, and that's held up pretty well. And I also used one of these X chromosome papers for my thesis to get into AGOS. So I was doing that sort of work. Well, then adults start coming to me, and transsexuals who within themselves thought they were born in the wrong body. And so they, wanted surgery and they wanted to be cared for. So I was probably the only person doing this sort of work. And so I met with Ben, and what can we do with these people? He said, well, Glory, take care of it. Take care of them. And so I started then seeing transsexuals and putting them on estrogens. And again, we had a team. We had Ben Glover, who was a psychiatrist, David Julian, and myself. And then Ben would help, because I had to get some help cover. Not everybody even wanted to take care of these patients. And so we treated them, and then we brought them in on the GYN service for surgery after about a year or two. And so I really had quite a few of patients, not a large number, but some. We were doing surgery, Minnesota was doing surgery. And and so I continued to do that surgery, and I used to get calls from everybody, and tragic calls. One of my patients said, beautiful long blonde hair, was found in a woman's bathroom in California, and they put her in jail and cut all her hair off, and terrible things happened. The surgeries, some of them went very well, but it really was very difficult, and the patients were difficult. And the interesting aside story on that was, I got a call from an attorney in Minnesota. One of the patients was going to be penalized because she was a prostitute. And in Minnesota, only women could be put in jail. I said, well, just do a buccal smear. you'll find that this person is not female, it's male. And he really laughed. I don't know if he used it or not, but he said, no problem. And so anyway, I did that surgery. And when I went to Northwestern, I continued to do some of it. But when I went there, I talked to some of the surgeons and said, listen, you know, they think this crazy gray-haired woman's coming down doing this crazy surgery. I said, this is, and then even when I was in New Mexico, I used to see some.
But did anyway, you have trouble with the nurses or the residents?
Oh, nurses, not so bad. You know, Mary Brisky was there, and she was pretty good. Mm-hmm. And Ann Gunderson were the nurses on 3 West, and they were pretty good. Bill Kiekhofer would help cover, and Ben, if I wasn't there. And so that we really, that's the only way we could do it. And we admitted the people in our service. If David Julian and I would operate together, and they were taking care of another service on Gainey. But it's, and all that, of course, John Money was also doing that work. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, even though he's now condemned, he was the first person that brought this stuff to light, I think. And I should give credit for that.
And where is he?
He was at Harvard or Hopkins or one of those school studies. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of an aside, but I continue to do my PhD, my work with amenorrheas and stuff like that.
Now, there was one other thing going on in those years in the department, and that's abortions.
Oh, yeah. Well, that, an abortion, well, then what happened with the abortion issue? We were getting a lot of young women coming back from Chicago, terribly infected.
Is this still when you were resident or when you were on the faculty?
Oh, I must have been a junior faculty then. Mm-hmm. More and more. And so the issues came up then when the whole business about abortion came up. And I remember I had a woman that went into septic shock, and you know, she almost died. And so we had young women who carried the pregnancies, were afraid to deliver because they were afraid they'd be kicked out of school, and they, I don't know how they could hide it, but they'd wear big sweaters, came in and delivered, and nobody knew about it, and we did that as well, because then they didn't know what was going to happen. So it was a difficult time. And in Wisconsin, they could do abortions, I don't know when this came about, to save the life of the mother.
Therapeutic abortion.
Therapeutic abortion.
In the 40s.
And so we were able to do that. And so we started doing some of those. Now, Lee Cannon did more of them, quite a few, and he was putting them on the operating room schedule. And it filled up the OR schedule, so we couldn't get the other patients on. And so I think it was decided, Ben met with him and said, you know, you can't fill up the schedule because the residents have to learn this, this, and this. And so Lee Kennan got a bit upset about that, and that's when he decided to go into town and start his own abortion unit. Now that might have been after Roe v. Wade. We were doing, after he left, because we couldn't do them in the operating room, Ben and I set up a unit on 4 East, I think. Yeah, because 3 West, 4 East. It was empty. And so we were doing abortions there under paracervical block and a little some medication for the patient. But when we first started doing it, we couldn't get anyone to help us. So he and I did it all. We could get housekeeping to bring the chairs up, but they wouldn't put them out. So we'd get there in time to put some chairs, and they'd be sitting in the hallway while we tried to get them in another room. And we were doing these just in a regular patient room. I mean, it was, you know, but it must have been a utility room because we were able to wash our instruments and get them sterilized. But Ben and I did all of that. And we only, you know, we only did a few to start with.
Now, was this after Roe?
That was before Roe, because every patient was having Ben Glover's. We worked it out so we would get the patient, would call, come in. They'd go to Ben Glover, who was a psychiatrist. He would write a note, and we would do the abortion.
Okay, and he was declaring them?
That it was to protect their health or their health. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and that's how we worked that before Roe v. Wade.
Mm-hmm. So they were all legal therapeutic abortions with his signature.
Yeah, they were all legal.
And how did the hospital administration, the nurses?
No, well, Ben and I were there alone. We didn't have a nurse. Mm-hmm. Then when the OB moved out of 3B, it must have been empty for a while. But then, I don't know if this could have been after. Well, it could have been. If we were 71, we moved the OB unit. And if 73 was Roe v. Wade, wasn't it?
Three,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, 73 was Roe v. Wade. So after that, maybe even a little bit before, we moved into 3B, where there were two delivery rooms and the labor rooms. And we had... then we had a counselor, and she would do all the scheduling. Because, you know, once you talk to somebody, you have no choice, but, you know, you take them. And so that we set that up, and it was really a nice unit. We had wonderful nurses there. And so it took it out of operating rooms where people didn't want to do it and all that stuff. We had women who were very much, you know, for abortion. Was wonderful for the patients. And we'd go back and forth to the two rooms. And we'd do almost 20 or so a day. And I'd finish
not
there,
every day. Did
would,
you do every day?
No, but when we did them.
When you did them.
Yeah. And we'd rotate. And my arms would just feel like they're going to drop. Residents at that time were required. They didn't have to do the procedure. But they had to be in on the counseling and talk to the patient. So we really had, that was part of their education. And so when residents were coming through and applying, they would say, do I have to do abortion? We'd say, no, you don't have to do the procedure, but yes, you have to be part of the counseling so you learn about it. When it first came out with Roe v. Wade, first came out, hospitals were supposed to do abortion. And there was an issue in Milwaukee because the medical college was, you know, part of Marquette at that time. And so Dick Mattingly, who was the chair there, didn't want to do any there. But there was some sort of rights that you had to be able to provide it. Then, of course, all that changed, and mm-hmm. I don't know when it changed. So we did our abortions there. And then we started doing... you know, we weren't doing up to 16, 8. I used to do up to 12, 14 weeks from below, but if it got much above that, 18, 20 weeks, now people are doing them all vaginally. So then we start using other sorts of things. We used to put hypertonic saline in the amniotic fluid and the amniotic sac. And then what happened, we had a little four-bed unit that was on 3 West. But we would admit the patients there. And again, we had nurses that would take care of them because not everybody would do that. And so we were doing some of those too at that time, and it was always Ben and myself that did it primarily. Sometimes Bill Kickoffer helped, but we did most of it.
And the other doctors approved or didn't approve? Or didn't say anything?
Didn't say anything. Because Lee Cannon was gone, and Bill Kickoffer was pretty flexible. He was.
And Horsell?
He didn't have any issues with it, but they didn't do a lot of it. I don't know why, it was just Penn and myself, I guess, because we felt strongly about it or something. And so we got that going, and it went pretty well. It was quite smooth. And then it was still When did they quit doing them, do you know? Because I think they were still doing abortions there when I went to Northwestern.
Oh.
And I went to Northwestern.
In the new hospital, they had a whole unit. They did.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think after Ben retired, that was after 85, I think they lost their courage or something.
Yeah, and then they stopped.
And I think any that had to be done, Ron Olson did over at Meredith.
Yeah, he did some at Meredith. And then, of course, Lee Kennett and Liz Carlin was doing them in the city then.
Right. I don't know how long Lee Kennett was here. He went down to his shopping center in
Florida.
Florida.
Yeah. And then Liz Carlin was doing them in town.
Now, she didn't do them at UW, though, did she? Because she didn't learn to do abortions here. I think she learned elsewhere.
Well, she was an internist, I thought. But she had associated positions originally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then she went in. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. And so that, you know, we were, I think I was doing them until I went to Northwestern. Mm-hmm. And then I even helped set up a program down there as well.
So how did you happen to go to Northwestern?
Well, then, I was obviously on the faculty, and Northwestern was really originally, most of the residency there was a private position residency when Ben was there. They didn't have full-time faculty. They had all their practitioners, and they did the residency, and it was a great residency. Those practitioners were really unbelievable. And so then they decided to have a full-time faculty. And Jack Shera went there from University of Minnesota and chaired the department there. And they were just building up their faculty, and then he recruited me. And so I talked to Ben, and Ben thought it probably would be a good thing for me to go. And I think he thought perhaps when he stepped down, maybe I could come back as chair. And as a matter of fact, he said that. And because, you know, I'll tell you, back when Ben was chair, most of the chairs had golden boys. Only Ben had a golden girl, mm-hmm. and I was that person. Mm-hmm. So he helped me all along the way. And, you know, I went to meetings with him. Even when I was here, remember, Ann? I'd go to meetings with him. Half the time I didn't know what to wear, and I talked to Ann, and how am I supposed to dress? She always said, Glory, you always look nice, don't worry about it. But I didn't even know, really, some of the time, you know, some of these meetings were the big meetings. I mean, when I got into the Society for Gynecologic Investigation, Ben Peckham put me up, and Terry Hayashi put me up for that. And I think I must have been, again, a third or fourth woman in that society. And then the same thing with AGOS. Ben put me up for that. Who was the woman that was from Women's Hospital who was in AGOS, but only about one or two. Mary Jane Gray was one of them. And so I was about the third or fourth woman in that as well. And then when Ben was president of the American Gynae Society, I went, you know, he took me along. So anyway, it was really wonderful. I mean, I really owe a lot of what I am to the mentoring and stuff that I have with Ben. And so anyway, he was recruiting. I think we thought, well, if I went down, maybe I'd get back. So I went to Northwestern in 76. And then I was there until 83. And when I was at Northwestern, I think that's when I became a director of the American Board of OBGYN, I was the first woman to be a director of the American Board of OBGYN. And Ruth Schwartz came on after I was on. She was from Rochester. And so I was down there, and I was the sort of the clinical director of the Prentice Women's Hospital. And Jack Sher was chair, and then I was there. And then I had a chance to come back and chair the Milwaukee campus. And so I came back and did that. And was Ben still chair at that time when I was in Milwaukee? Mm-hmm. And so I was at Milwaukee and stayed there a couple of years, but it just wasn't academic enough for me. And I think I was there for 2 or 3 years. And even though it was just 100 miles away, I just wasn't really very academic. And the person who was quite the associate dean down there, the department was getting too strong, and I think he was threatened, and so made a few waves, and so I thought...
This was Dick Rieselbach?
Dick Rieselbach, yeah. And so I stayed until I could find what I wanted. And I had looked at a couple of chairs. I looked at North Carolina, but when I went down and looked at North Carolina, the chair of medicine said he'd never have a woman in his department. So they weren't quite open to having a woman chair at that time. And I looked at several other chairs. Well, then the one at the University of New Mexico opened. And so I went down and looked at that chair. And Napolitano was the dean down there. And I was quite upfront with him. I told him what happened at Milwaukee. I said, you're going to hear all sorts of things, but let me tell you. He says, Glory, he says, I know you worked hard, and I know you're going to do a good job. Don't worry about it. So he hired me, and I was there from 86 until 97 about.
Can I ask one question before you get down to New Mexico? When you were in Chicago, well, even maybe when you were here and in training, did you go through the maternity center in Chicago at all in training, or
Ben,
did you send
Ben stopped that. The old Chicago maternity center where they went out and delivered.
Yeah.
When Ben came.
He came to Wisconsin.
When he came to Wisconsin. Because he was at Northwestern.
Yeah, and he used to train people there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that was stopped. So I never went down there.
It stopped with Sam Pearlson was the first resident. He was in his residency when Ben took the job. He must have been a year. Because Ben came up in June of 56.
Was Sam already a resident?
Sam was already a resident.
Yeah.
And he was down at the maternity center. And at County, too. Weren't they at County?
Yeah.
I don't remember. But anyway, he called Sam and he said, I've taken the job. Get back to Madison. And they were all thrilled to get out of there.
Well, students who used to go down there.
Yeah, that's what I thought. They continued to go down.
No. When Ben came, I didn't go down there. And I was mad to be the second class that Ben took.
I had some evidence that students were still going down into the late 60s. So where does that come from? I'm going to have to look into this. This is very strange. And I think you told me that before.
No,
I
don't.
To look up
to the best of my recall, they didn't go down after
once
he came.
Once Ben came here.
No. They were farmed out because there wasn't enough OB at University Hospital.
Yeah, we went to St. Mary's and Madison General then. But even as a student, I didn't go to Chicago.
Okay.
And if he came in 56, I graduated in 58, so I would have gone.
Well, I just had an email. We can discuss that another time.
Mm-hmm. Don't you thought it was still, people were still,
yeah.
I think the maternity center probably was still going, but I don't think we were going down there.
No, it was still going until 72 or 3 it closed down. But, okay. I'll figure that out.
Even when I was when I went to Northwestern in 76, well, it's been after that, because 76 I went to Northwestern.
Yeah,
it was
incorporated into Prentice
by that time.
Okay. New Mexico.
Oh, New Mexico. Anyway, so I went to New Mexico, and with Dean Napolitano, and he'd been dean there for 12 or, you know, he was one of the longest running deans, I think, in the country. And that was a difficult department when I went down there. J. Robert Wilson was there, and that's part of the reason I went, because J. Robert Wilson was chair at Michigan for a long time, and he and Ben were good friends, and I was at some meeting, I think, American College of Obstetrician Gynecologists, and I think he came up to me and said, Glory, would you take a look at our place? And I said, well, I don't know. He said, well, I'm going to put your name in. That's how I got started. J. Robert Wilson is the one that, and Elsie Carrington was there. And Elsie Carrington was in the,
Albuquerque.
J. Robert Wilson talked to me about going down looking at it. And I said, okay, because I respected him. And I thought he probably wouldn't have me looking. And so I went down look at the job. And then the dean, they had a couple people through. And I went through. And he said, nope, I want her. And that's how it's going to be. So it was a difficult department. Now, J. Robert was teaching, and Elsie Carrington was still doing some teaching. But they had some faculty down there that weren't teachers like we were taught to be teachers. And so when I went down there, we used to come in for deliveries. We used to go to the operating room with all of our residents and teach them. They didn't do that. And I said, you have to go down and to teach, teach. And they said, well, I'm not going to go down there for a nickel an hour. I said, well, a nickel an hour is better than nothing an hour. I said, besides that, you're getting paid to teach. That's what we're really supposed to do with our salaries. And so the first time I was there, I got there like in October. And so they had the resident graduation, which they always do, and they had it in a restaurant, and a couple of the graduating residents and one of the faculty told stories about patients that I just couldn't believe. You know, I never heard the term dirtball, but they called patients dirtballs. And I said to that faculty after that he would not get another contract. And so that was that. But a lot of the other faculty got sort of worried. And so they were all going to meet, and they were going to resign en masse, except for J. Robert Wilson and Elsie and one other person. And so I talked to the dean. The dean said, Gloria, we'll talk with them. He said, you don't want them to all resign now because you're working so hard you couldn't do it all. He said, but we'll talk to them, and as you start recruiting faculty, you just let them go. And almost everyone left as I started, except the two people that sort of stayed with me through that. And so then I was able to build a department. When I went there, there were about five or six faculty, and they were in the red. When I left there, we had, I think, about 15 or 16 faculty, and we had $1 million set aside in endowment. And so we really grew the department. We had research and everything going. And so that went well, and after 10 years, and the new dean, I think, had a lot. We were a very strong department, and so things were coming up. And so, I resigned as chair and hung around for a year. And that's hard to do. And they didn't
get.
Why did
you resign as chair? I missed.
I went there in 86, and I resigned in 96. So I hung around for a year.
Why did you resign?
From there, stuff going on with the dean and giving me a hard time, and so I just that's it. And it was my 10 years anyway. But I think there was a lot of stuff going on in the school. I think a lot of the departments were threatened. We were really growing. And I get, you know, I've had two things in my life where it's been difficult. One was a Theresa Bach in Milwaukee, and that was a very difficult time for me. And this thing in New Mexico was sort of that way, but not as bad as this thing with Theresa Bach. And, you know, attacking me and my lifestyle and went beyond just what I was doing. And so I stepped down in 96, hung around for a year, and then decided to come up and do a sabbatical. And I was looking at Northwestern because I was interested in health economics and how it affects women's health. And so I went to, thought about Northwestern, their Kellogg School, and then the University of Chicago also has a good school in economics. I mean, they have Nobel Prize winners and everything. So, but then, because Lisa and I had the girls then, we were interested in the school system. And so I decided to come back to Madison. And I was going to come back on sabbatical and then maybe go back and pay my year, but I wasn't going to stay there. And so we moved the girls up and I came up on sabbatical.
You had all four girls?
All four girls, yeah. And Brighton was just a baby, though she was real little. And so we moved up for the school system. And then when I was here, I started working with Molly Carnes and Women's Health, and she had put in for this National Center of Excellence in Women's Health the first round, but didn't get it, so we were resubmitting that. And so we worked on it together, and then she said, we don't want you to go back. And so I wrote the dean down there and said, you know, I'll be happy to come back and pay back my year, but I want you to know now I am not going to stay. I wanted to set up a Women's Health Center down there, but money was hard, and so I didn't do that. And so he said, well, Gloria, as long as you're up there with the girls and everything, we'll just do some way to make you an administrative person. And so then I didn't have to go back. And so I've been going since then. I don't know if you want to hear more about what's happened since then. But so I feel very fortunate and blessed, really, to be able to come back and be able to fit in and do what I'm doing. I mean, it's been wonderful, and I'm really having a good time.
And so what are you doing?
Oh, well, I came back, and then I was co-director of the Center for Women's Health, National Center of Excellence. And then Molly and I parlayed that into University of Wisconsin Center for Women's Health Research. And so I'm co-director of that. I'm co-director of the Center for the Study of Cultural Diversity in Healthcare, which is looking at minorities in our medical school with Gloria Johnson Powell. And so I'm doing that as well. I've got research going, and so I've been writing grants and getting those funded. I was the interim director for the Maternal Fetal Medicine Division. The dean asked me if I would do that. And so now we have a director there, and we just put in for a fellowship, and we're going to get that. And then I was assistant dean for one of the gender issues, following after Judy Lovett. And that was okay and worked well for a while. And so I'm just doing committee work and doing stuff and enjoying it.
Now, is this, I don't know what the National Center for Excellence is. Is this all on paper? There's no clinical part of it?
No, there is, but we don't provide the care. We have UW West, which is there, and the Veterans Women's Hospital, which are our clinical arm.
Mm-hmm.
And then
the Women's Health Initiative?
No, that's different.
That's separate.
That's different. This is the National Center of Excellence in Women's Health. And that is, they funded originally six. And Arlen Specter was very involved in getting those funded. And so that Pennsylvania has at least two, or had three at one time. And
I wonder how that happened.
Yeah. But anyway, subsequent from that, that's under the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Women's Health, not the Office of Research on Women's Health, which is at the NIH. They have now, they started out with six, then they added another six, and now there are, there are 16 or 18 National Centers of Excellence in Women's Health. And I just have now, I'm director of a research coordinating center for research among the National Centers of Excellence in Women's Health, and I just wrote a proposal to get that. And so that is that. Now, the Women's Health Initiative is separate from that. And I just, in the last year, became the PI for that. Because Kit Allen, who was the original PI, principal investigator for that, had leukemia and died. Young woman, wonderful woman. And before she died, she asked me if I would take it over. So I said I would. And so now I'm the PI on that. And so that is what's going on with the National Centers of Excellence. Now I'll let you in on something else, but it's got to stay in this room.
You want this off?
No, it's okay. I don't know if anything's going to come of it. But these National Centers of Excellence in Women's Health are funded through DHHS. And we were very lucky because Donna Shalala was the secretary and she was very supportive of women's health. And then Tommy Thompson, even though he's Republican, was also very supportive of women's health. And so that money has gone into that. But they've been decreasing the amount of money that can go to the National Centers of Excellence. And Juana Jones, who's the head there now, Susan Blumenthal was the original head. And so she stepped down, Donna Shalala asked her to step down, as a matter of fact. So then Juana Jones got the job, but Juana Jones is a public health person, so she wants community centers of excellence. So the academic centers of excellence aren't getting very much money anymore. So I've been having in the back of my head that I thought we ought to get centers for women's health research funded through the NIH. Well, I got the first idea from Paul Carbone because he was very involved in developing the clinical centers, the cancer centers. And he said to me, Gloria, you have to get these appropriated through Congress, through the NIH. Then you'll have them. Well, I've been thinking about that. So what I did, just this last 3 months, I wrote a bill to have at a minimum of 20 women's health research centers funded through the NIH for $1.5 to $2 million each. Well, you know, the cancer centers get a lot of money. And then another $1 million for research. And I had talked with Tammy Baldwin, who's been wanting to introduce a women's health bill into Congress. And so I met with her aide.
Geraldine Goodman?
Huh?
Geraldine Goodman?
No, Elizabeth Pica, who's, I don't know
it's
if you know
Geraldine
her.
Geraldine who lives right here.
Yeah.
Her press secretary.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yes, she's a neighbor.
Yeah.
So,
a friend of mine.
Is she the press secretary?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought she was.
So anyway, Elizabeth Pica, who does her medical stuff. And so I've been involved with the NIH a lot. I mean, I've done a lot. I've been on the council for NICHD, and I've been on study sections. And I was also on that whole story about how all this came about is also interesting. I was on the Vivian Pinn, who's the director of the Office of Research on Women's Health, who's at the NIH. I was on her advisory committee, and so I know Vivian really quite well. And so I couldn't send her an email because she can't be involved in any of this politics stuff. So I talked with her. I said, I'm going to send this bill to Tammy Baldwin, and I want to read it to you. So I read this whole thing and said why we had to have it. So about 3 weeks ago, I sent it off to Tammy Baldwin. And it just happens that the NIH Revitalization Act hasn't been redone since the early 90s, when we first got the Office of Research on Women's Health in the Congress. And so she's hoping to be able to add it to that as an amendment.
Fantastic.
And it may not, you know, may not happen, but at least I sent that off, and hopefully we'll, you know, it's been something I've been wanting to do. And so we'll see what happens with it. Getting back to the whole business about women's health, when Bernadine Healy was director of the NIH, she had meetings whereby she tried to set research agendas. She sent one for the NIH, and I was on a couple of committees for that. But then also, we were the Society for Women's Health Research, of which I'm a founding member. There are only about probably five or six of us when we started. There aren't many more now. But we, with Florence Hasseltine, who's at the NICHD, is an obstetrician gynecologist. And I remember when she was going to go to work there, I had lunch with her at the SGI. She said, Gloria, what do you think I ought to do? I said, well, Florence, I said, I think it'd be a good idea, because from there you might become a dean of a medical school, which didn't happen. But anyway, so she did take the job. And it was clear at the NIH that there weren't very many women at the NIH. There was very little done in women's health. So we went to Patricia Schroeder and Olympia Snow, who were, I think, sort of the chair of the Congressional Women's Caucus. And Henry Waxman was in charge of some one of the committees. And we went to them and said, you know, women aren't being included in research. So we decided that it ought to be studied. So that's when they had the Office of, OMB or something, of Congress, to do a study and look in whether or not the NIH was having women in clinical trials, or look at whether or not NIH was doing research in women's health. And that in 1990, the report came out and hit every newspaper in the country. I remember reading the Los Angeles Times that women were not being included in clinical trials. So subsequent to that, when we then pushed to have the Society for Women's Health Research, of which there were about five or six of us, pushed to have Congress develop the Office of Research on Women's Health. So 1990 was the last NIH revitalization. And then the Office of Women's Health Research was put in there. And then we've had several things looking at research in women's health. But so now, I heard that this NIH revitalization thing was coming up again. So I thought I'd better get it into Tammy. And so I sent it off about 3 weeks ago. And we'll see what happens with it.
Is any of this, these are all studies, right?
No, that...
Does any of it translate into hands-on clinics? Sort of thing?
Oh, well, yeah, I think all the research I'm doing in and now is clinical research with women.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully, I think good clinical science, which is care, is based on good basic science. And you have to have the research in order to get it translated into good clinical care.
Mm-hmm.
So they do have a women's health clinic here
mm-hmm.
on our campus.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I think that it is resulting in that. And of course, the Women's Health Initiative is now going another 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we're having a big meeting in Washington about that. But so that's, a lot of it is studies, but hopefully it gets into the clinical care arena.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm hoping to get these research centers. That's my big dream. I said, if it happens, it happens. But if you don't try, it'll never happen. So,
yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
You have been in
four medical schools.
Yep.
Do you have any feeling on the quality of faculty and care and so forth between the private and the public schools? Oh. And when you were at Mount Sinai, that's private, is it not?
Mount Sinai itself is private, but it's the Milwaukee Clinical Campus for this school.
For this school, all right.
Yeah. So we had the faculty there, were full-time faculty, plus mm-hmm. a lot of private docs
mm-hmm.
who brought their patients in there.
Mm-hmm.
But we had about five or six full-time faculty then.
Mm-hmm.
But Northwestern?
Well, Northwestern was interesting because we had a large indigent patient population. Of course, Prentice was a brand new hospital. We had a full-time, wonderful OB anesthesiology department. So we had OB anesthesiologists right there, and epidurals. It was wonderful for patients who wanted them. And whereas here, you know, we didn't have that. And so I think the care there continued to be really quite good. We had full-time faculty and private practitioners that would cover all the deliveries. We were in the operating room for all of the operating room cases. So I think the care there was really very good. And of course, it has a top notch. I mean, it's got all the elite from Chicago, the private docs, you know, all of the North Shore going there. And Northwestern, now if you've ever been down there, Wesley's been torn down, Passavant's torn down, brand new buildings are going up in their stead, and their new hospital is like unbelievable. And they're building a new women's hospital there that is supposed to be out of sight. They have more money there. I can't get over it. And have you been down there at all?
Well, I have. I walked around. I was mystified to see Wesley was gone.
Yeah.
They hadn't taken Passavant down the last time I was there. All those clinical buildings I thought were very ugly. Maybe I was just looking at the parking ramp.
Well, I don't know. I mean, looking at the outside, they might be ugly, but they're
inside, they're wonderful.
Yeah, they're supposed to be. They're just going to be building the women's mm-hmm. hospital, but it'll be unbelievable. There's money, so much money in Chicago. It's unbelievable.
Right, sure.
When I was there and I wanted to do prenatal classes for an indigent population, and so what I did was I said, you know, I was thinking about the library buses that go out in the country, because I was in the country and they stopped. And I said, maybe we could get a bus. So I went with the Northwestern development people. We went to two banks and we got like $50,000 or $60,000 to get a big bus. And then we went to Cabrini Green, and because they didn't have to go into the tenements. And they would come into our bus, and we provided prenatal classes. And then when they finished, they'd have a little graduation at Northwestern. And that went on while I was there. I don't know what happened to it after I left.
And then they delivered at Wesley?
At Prentice Women's Hospital, mm-hmm. yeah. They all came in there. And so I did quite a bit of stuff with that. It was really a beautiful little bus. And
did you teach them Lamaze?
Yeah, we taught all of that sort of stuff, yeah. And so we, and it was nice because they had, you know, we went there. I think even now, this business of building these beautiful clinics, huge, and expect people to come to them is a mistake.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm very interested in disparities in health. I think we'd be better off in Milwaukee to have little storefront, one or two room clinics where they can walk to them. And it's not an issue.
Okay.
But instead we keep building these big things and people aren't coming to them. So anyway.
What is your perception when you go to national meetings at all? What is your perception of how they rate the University of Wisconsin Medical School?
Oh, I think the University of Wisconsin Medical School is rated very highly. I think the Department of OBGYN, much to my dismay, is not. I think the chair they have had for the last 12 years or whatever it is, has been absolutely bad for the department. It can be a sterling department. It can be the best. We have wonderful people in the department. It's got a lot of potential, but it never happened. You can turn that off if you want.
Is it energy level or is it something else?
With the chair, I don't know what it is. I worry about some of that. Mm-hmm. But it was the dean when I came back.
Do you want this on the tape?
No, it can come off.
So why did they move OBGYN out of University Hospital?
I think it's Donna Sullenberger. She really, Molly and I met with her, and I said, you know, there are really some women's health things that are not going on. I said, women come in here, I bet they haven't asked, they don't ask them if they had a mammography. They could have been 5 years from the time they had one. They probably don't ask them if they've had pap smears. I mean, it could be part of the nurse's intake. I mean, it doesn't have to be the physicians doing it. If they hadn't had one, at least offer it. It's like I never said anything. And we talked to her about that. She said, I guess that's right, but women's health is not one of my priorities. And what her priorities are, you know, the transplant program, the big money earners, because, you know, they're building the children's hospital. Even if they put two floors on top of that, they could have had a women's and children. But she wasn't interested in that at all. So then, as of course, OB was over there, and then... I think what happened with Gynie is that in the operating room is so full, she doesn't know what to do with what, and you have a chair that doesn't fight for anything. She said, well, we've got to move Gynie out, the Gynie surgery. And so they're moving GYN out, except for Tom Julian. I mean, he just said he was going to leave if they moved him. And so they moved that out. They have moved the OBGYN administrative offices to 20 South Park, and they have offices there, and we have, and I think now they're going to find the endocrine infertility is still at the U. They're going to build a building somewhere, and they're going to move them over there, and so there won't be any women's health at the women's health, university hospitals. It's ridiculous. You know, if someone goes into labor, it goes in the emergency room there, you have to have an obstetrician, got to have someone to know what to do with it. They're going to call the people from Meritor. Meritor, on the other hand, is willing to build the women's. They're going to probably take that whole one wing and make it a women's hospital.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they're the ones that gave us the space for the Center for Women's Health because we couldn't get any space over at the U. And so that's what's going on. It's purely administrative. She that's not what her area is. And I know where she came from. She was at the University of Illinois. It's, you know, in South Illinois. And she was an administrator for the Department of Surgery. And from there she went to the City of Hope.
Which is cancer.
And so she came here, and so it's surgery, transplant, cancer, and that's what her area is, and not women's health.
Good heavens. We're going to start another tape and continue this discussion.
For a little while.
Who was...